Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the Stone Chapel Podcast. I'm David Capes. Sandra Glahn joins us today on the podcast. She's a professor at Dallas Theological Seminary. That's DTS in the biz. She's written a book entitled Nobody's Mother, Artemis of the Ephesians in Antiquity and the New Testament. And she's challenging a number of assumptions about the goddess Artemis. And these are assumptions that have been held for about 1,500 years now. And how rereading those texts influences what we think today about Paul's letters and the book of Acts in particular. So stick around for the next 19 minutes and see how that works out in the New Testament. So today, Sandra Glahn on the Stone Chapel Podcast.
I'm Dr. Sandra Glahn. I'm Professor of Media Arts and Worship at Dallas Theological Seminary.
Dr. Sandra Glahn, good to see you.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us today.
Totally a pleasure to be here.
Yeah.
On a gorgeous day.
And it's a nice day and a nice setting, too,
yeah,
as well. Now, we've just had a conference here. And give us just 30 seconds. What have we witnessed here?
See Her Story was the title of the conference. It was put on by the Visual Museum of Women in Christianity. And we're trying to recover some of that visual history that doesn't get told about women in the early church specifically across the world. And what did women do?
And you can find out more about that at the gallery, right?
Visualmuseum.gallery, yes.
Yeah.
Thanks.
This is the first one I've ever seen, visualmuseum.gallery. Are there other galleries out there?
There are.
Okay.
Yes, it's
okay.
Apparently an art space.
Okay.
I learned it too.
Still,
I didn't know either.
So visualmuseum.gallery
yes.
is the place to go. Some wonderful images and commentary about the interesting places that women were in the visual record.
Yeah.
We talk a lot about written text. We talk a lot about archaeology.
Right.
But there's this whole field of art that comes down to us through the ages that tells part of that story.
Mosaics, so, and frescoes, and paintings, and inscriptions. Yes, all of that.
All right, for those who don't know, who is Sandra Glahn?
I love to write. I love to travel. I love my husband of 45 years. I'm the wife of one husband, the mother of one grown child, and then the nana of one who was born about a year ago and is perfect.
Totally perfect.
Totally
in every
perfect.
Way.
Yep.
All right. So you at Dallas Theological Seminary,
True.
And how long have you been there?
I've been teaching there since 1999.
1999.
We got here in 81 for my husband to go there, so we've been part of the institution for a really long time.
Okay. And you've done a number of important books, but the one we're going to talk about today is entitled Nobody's Mother. The subtitle is Artemis of the Ephesians in Antiquity and the New Testament, and is published by
IVP Academic.
IVP Academic.
Yeah.
Nobody's Mother by Artemis of the Ephesians in Antiquity and the New Testament by Sandra Glahn. All right. Have you been surprised at the reception this book has received?
Here's my biggest surprise. I thought this would be a woman's book. Women looking at who was this woman mentioned in the book of Acts, Acts 19. They're chanting, great is Artemis of the Ephesians. We think that it might have influenced Paul as he's writing 1 Timothy. And since that's a women's, so-called women's text, that's what I thought that would be the response.
So a bunch of women would come around and be really excited and happy about the book.
Or
unhappy. Say,
yeah, yeah, exactly. It would be both.
Okay,
but,
all right.
But it really, I've been pleasantly surprised at how many of my brothers have come alongside and said, that has been a head scratcher, some of those texts. I looked specifically at She Will Be Saved Through Childbearing. And what does that mean?
1 Timothy 2:12.
Well, 12 is the one about teaching, and
right.
I don't touch
but
on that
2:15
a lot.
But
2:15 is part of the why.
Okay.
And then, well, the why follows it, and then it's sort of the consolation prize, if you will. I mean, that's really kind of a negative way of saying it. I think Paul really cares about women. And so he's saying, I got bad news and I got good news. But say through childbearing is part of the good news. But in my tradition, I had really been taught that that means a woman's place is in the nuclear family. And there were a couple ways that didn't make sense. It didn't seem to fit Paul's view of spiritual gifts. It didn't seem to fit his telling the Corinthians to think about staying single. And then my husband and I hit the brick wall of infertility and pregnancy loss. So then it didn't fit the life that I had. And so it drove the question. But your original question was the response to it. And yeah. brothers have come alongside and said, I didn't feel comfortable telling women your place is in the home. Uh-huh. And that's what that was teaching. And it didn't really fit my understanding of Pauline authorship. And it didn't really fit his message in other places. And now it sort of makes a lot more sense. Like I said, that was a surprise.
So you began looking then at Paul and trying to understand 1 Timothy 2. But right. Artemis now becomes such an important feature. I mean, it's part right. of the subtitle.
Correct.
And the title is Nobody's Mother.
Because people think she's a fertility goddess. So okay. I'm coming right out in the beginning going, that is not what she is. Okay. So here's the logic. It really starts in the biblical text. 1 Timothy 1:3, Paul says to Timothy, I left you in Ephesus for you to teach certain people not to teach false doctrine. And then we ask, well, then what were the false doctrines? And we tend to just look in the letters to Timothy, but we forget that Paul is described in great detail in Ephesus in Acts 19. Mm-hmm. And the first half sort of is looking at magic and how Jesus is better than the magic workers. And then the second half is the Artemis silver workers saying, whoa, this Christianity thing's really cutting into our economics. This is a bad thing. And they fill the theater and they're chanting for 2 hours, great is Artemis of the Ephesians. So I got my clues from the biblical text, actually, long before I got them from the culture. It was those pointers in the text that made me go, okay, then who was she? And sort of the reigning teaching has been, well, she's a fertility goddess, and Paul had a fertility goddess on his mind, and that's why he said women will be saved through childbearing. And I got to digging and discovered she's really the exact opposite. She's nobody's mother.
Nobody's mother.
She's a confirmed
virgin. So how
did
she get the reputation? One
major source of that is Jerome. In the fourth century, he describes her as being polymaston, many-breasted. Those are probably not breasts on her statue. It's probably some like pectoral kind of armor. One of the ways we know that is her hands are ebony, her feet are ebony, her face is ebony. The rest of her is marble, white marble, which doesn't really match skin, right? There are a couple different ways we know that. But anyway,
we're looking
that
at images at that point.
We are,
right?
We're looking at lots of statues
and things like that that have been found, and it's a very common image.
It
if
is,
you go to Ephesus today, you'll go to the gift shop, they'll sell you an image of her. I think I've got one of the ones around
you
here somewhere.
You probably do. Somebody bought me one too, and I was like, no, I'm not a fan of Artemis. You misunderstand. She was the enemy.
She wasn't the pleasant person.
No, she was not.
So not a mother, not a nurturer so much.
Not at all a nurturer. Yeah, right. She killed children and killed women about as often as she killed men, maybe even more often.
So how did you parse out the true picture?
Yeah, great question. So when you go to Ephesus today, which I'm sure you've done, they will give you what I call the synoptic Ephesus. And they'll talk about what was going on in the 7th century BC and the 5th BC and, you know, down to the 4th century AD. And, you know, you got 11 centuries there. And all we really need to know if we're looking at the biblical text is who was she at the time of Paul? So the PhD work I did was at the University of Texas at Dallas in the humanities with a focus on Greek and Ephesus. And so I wanted historians who didn't know anything about Paul to vet my work of how do I figure out just what's happening in the first centuries BC and AD. And through the guidance of my historian teachers was, it's called your tools of analysis. One tool of analysis is the inscriptions. One tool is the statues. One tool is the stamps. One tool is the literature, and the Book of Acts is actually the best literature we have on that. So by dividing those out in categories, those became different chapters in the book of what does the evidence say here? And what does it say here? And one of those chapters is looking at coins and statues that have those bulbous images all over her front. And what were they? Probably a Hittite magic sex. And then when you figure that out, you go, oh, well, the magicians in the Book of Acts. And then the story of Artemis. I had read them as completely two separate spiritual forces.
Then
I look in the inscriptions and discover, well, they're actually magic curses that have Artemis behind them. So we see an overlap.
It's like the power of Artemis is behind these.
Okay. Yeah.
So she's really a frightening figure.
She's terrifying.
When you think about it. She's meant to be, because these gods were meant to intimidate people who's not. A follower.
That's right. But also she was perceived by women at the time to be the one with the power if you didn't tick her off to either deliver you safely through childbearing or to kill you painlessly with a euthanizing arrow. And in the mythological story of her life that Homer tells, she watched her mother give birth to her baby twin, Apollo, and her mother writhed for 9 days giving birth. And Artemis goes to Daddy Zeus and said, "No way am I doing that. Make me immune to Aphrodite's love arrows. I don't want love. I don't want marriage. I don't want sex. I don't want any of that." And so she's a confirmed virgin and hunts. And most of us, we know anything about Artemis. We do think of her as a hunter. But when you look at that thing with the bulbous images all over her, there has been, particularly in the West, the association of all of that with mothering and then nurturing. And so she's been perceived as a nurturing goddess, and she was anything but.
Anything but.
There was just no evidence.
Are there other places where we've gotten the wrong impression by looking too facilely at the evidence,
you think? I can't really answer that because I've been stuck in it for about 25 years in this dark Artemis hole. And at one point I came out and my husband is like, "You know John Wayne died, right?" I guess it's every scholar's curse. Right?
Yeah. Sometimes you don't know what's going on in the world because you're so locked in. But it strikes me that there's probably a lot of those kind of stories that we tell as sort of common knowledge assumptions that if we really looked at them, we would decide, well, wait, that doesn't really hold water. The evidence is not there for
that. There is one that comes to mind now that you say that, and that is we've had the idea in the West that there was temple prostitution all over the Roman world. Mm-hmm. And again, there's really not any evidence that that happened. It's probably rooted in geographer Strabo from the first century talks about at some time in the past, Corinth had orgies on the top of the hill. But it wasn't contemporary with him. He's just got hearsay, and that's really the evidence we ran on. And you start looking at the architecture, the images, the writings, and you find nothing. If anything, again, there are some confirmed virgins. Not that there's not immorality going on, but it's not a part of the temple cult,
right?
As we've
right.
sometimes thought.
Right. When you come to the bottom line for you as you look at Paul, and you try to analyze Paul and the figure of Artemis and what we're learning from her. When he says in 1 Timothy 2:15, she,
ooh,
the woman.
Are we going to go there?
Do you want to go there? She'll be saved by childbearing.
Not I am. Oh, yeah. Okay.
I mean, you don't have to give away the whole.
Well, I mean, the title gives it away. She's nobody's mother.
Nobody's
mother. But saved through childbearing, my hypothesis is that Paul, as he so commonly does, is borrowing a local saying. We see him do that up on Mars Hill when he says, "One of your own poets has said God is near to us," right? And he's always looking at the current context to say, how can I build a bridge? I think he is taking the number one fear of women, which is childbirth, because that is the number one killer of women. Mm-hmm. Number one killer of men at the time is war. But for women, it's childbirth. Mm-hmm. And there's pressure to give birth to children because of war. So the emperor has all kinds of incentives for you to build his empire and give him an army. So there's pressure on women to give birth. I think Paul is a friend to women. I think he's concerned about their biggest fear. And I think in the context of a stronghold, which is childbirth, and whether you're protected in childbirth, he's telling Timothy, a woman isn't going to die. I don't think he's saying it for everyone, for all time. I think he has a habit of looking at whatever city he's in, at the stronghold, and saying Jesus is better. And I think we see something like that with the magic workers in the beginning of that section of Acts I was talking about. Mm-hmm. People just bring their handkerchiefs or aprons to Paul, and he touches them, and they're healed. That is not normative. But it is fighting a stronghold, and you see the result where they see Jesus is stronger than the magic workers.
Right.
They burn their books.
Yeah.
And so then you might ask, well, what about the other stronghold, which is childbearing? And I think he's saying, this is a faithful saying. You know, a woman will be saved through childbearing. This is a faith. If she continues in the faith, basically.
Right, continues in the faith. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And then the very next line is, this is a faithful saying, but we usually have a new paragraph, a new chapter heading, and say, this is a faithful saying. If someone aspires to be an elder, that person aspires to a good thing. I think we need to be matching it with what came before it rather than after. So then I started looking at, does Paul ever do that? Yes, he does. In fact, it's a little bit like half and half. So that didn't actually tip the scales very well for us to
say. Yeah, but it's not a bad argument, though.
But it could happen because he's done it before.
Because all those periods and paragraphs are something that we, as editors, do a little bit later on. Right?
That's right.
So when you say she will be saved, you're not talking about eternal salvation, right? I mean,
absolutely.
Even though that's a word that can be used for
that. It can be. So there are really only two ways you see shall be saved, and that that form of the word is shall be saved. It's future. You see it to talk about eternity, but you also see it used for physical death.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is how he is using it here. Mm. But I don't think that he coined the phrase. I think he's saying, yeah, you want to talk about saved through childbearing? I'll give you a saved through childbearing. Mm. Jesus is better.
Mm. All the way.
All the way.
So it struck me as you were going through the Acts 19 part about how bad Jesus could be for the economy.
Yeah.
You know, in a way. You know,
it's the economy, stupid.
It wouldn't be good for the economy.
It would not be good for the economy.
Yeah. And then obviously for the magic workers. And for those who don't know, when you say magic, you're not talking about illusions at a circus.
Right, correct. Right? I'm talking curses, talking about calling on supernatural powers or love potions. It's not always negative, right? It's controlling things through the supernatural and thinking that you can appease the gods to doing that.
And we've discovered bowls and we've discovered these magical kinds of things, amulets and such.
Yes, correct.
All over the world at the time because they thought that by saying those or wearing those items that they could actually have power over the powers.
Correct. Paul is saying, if it's made with hands, it's not really a god. He never comes out and says anything negative about Artemis. In fact, the city clerk goes, he hasn't slandered the goddess. He's a good Jew. I don't think he's ever going to mention the name of another god. Now, Luke, he might pull out the name of Hermes when he's telling his story. Right. But Paul, you will only see him go around the corner to go, you know, gods made with hands aren't really gods.
Well, the book is done beautifully, and people have been very interested in it. But I think you've really struck a chord. So what are you going to do next?
As IVP came back and said, we would like a woman's places in the story. And re-looking at Bible stories where, like, you take, like, a Tamar in Genesis, and it's sorted, so we might even just skip it in our series. And we don't realize Tamar's encounter with Judah is essential to his character arc, where the very next time we see him, after he's encountered her, he's giving his life for Benjamin. He had trafficked his brother, Joseph. Now he's offering his life for Benjamin. What changed? Well, it's an encounter with somebody who took seriously the promise of Messiah coming through his family, even when he didn't value it.
And Tamar is mentioned in the genealogy Jesus. I mean,
she is. That's right. And
she's one of four or five women that are mentioned at that point. And,
which is unusual.
And there's all kinds of theories about all that. I mean, I think I know. I think I have the right one, but, you know, I don't know what you think, but I have the right one. But it's it really, I think, takes women and shows the importance of them in the story.
Yes, women and men in the story.
Yeah. And Judah says of her, well, she was the just one.
Correct.
She was the one who was
exactly
righteous.
Exactly right.
You know, and she did the right thing. She did the truthful thing. Remarkable. We don't tell those stories.
We need to tell them. So apparently that's what IVP wants me to do is go back to some of those texts where we have tended to cameo women when we do tell their story. Mm-hmm. We might have a study of women in the Bible and we pull them out of their context, which is fine. But we need to actually tell the story as it was written to see where do these people fit in the plot. The midwives in Moses' day or another, they're named. We have actual names.
That's pretty unusual.
And it's pretty unusual.
Yeah.
The daughters of Zelophehad, their story gets told five times in the Old Testament. They are all named. Mm. Why are we not talking about them?
Yeah. Well, it's fascinating, and we're grateful, first of all, for the book that you've done. I think you've clarified a lot of things about some the methods in history and how we should be working these assumptions, and then bringing us, I think, to the right conclusion about how we should be reading Paul there in 1 Timothy chapter 2. But Sandra Glahn, thank you for being with us today on the Stone Chapel podcast.
Enjoyed it.
Thanks. Thanks to Sandra Glahn for being with us today on the Stone Chapel podcast. What a great guest she is. So clear and articulate, just like her book, Nobody's Mother. Thanks to Kathy Capes for editing this podcast, making it available to you. Thanks to Phil Keggy for our music. The podcast itself is made possible by the good people at the Lanier Foundation. Lots of great things coming up at the Lanier Theological Library in the rest of this year and even in the spring next year. So make sure you sign up for our newsletter. It drops once a month with details about events and guests happening here at the library. This is a place, as you've seen if you know it, of solace and discovery. Until next time, I'm David Capes. Thanks for listening.